Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of November 2nd, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Jay.
You may have noticed that we didn't do a podcast last week. That's because Mike and I went on a camping trip guided by our good friend, Gak Stone. And the mission was to get some photos of the Comet Lemon with a historic bridge over the Rio Grande River in the foreground. Mike, did we accomplish the mission?
We sure did, Jay. That was just a fantastic time out there. The bridge was awesome. The comet was awesome. And then the petroglyphs and other archaeological features was awesome. The Rio Grande is always awesome, hence the name. It was a bit cold late October for camping and sleeping out under the stars. I think you woke up with a little bit of frost on you. Weather. Taking a look at the space weather, this week we have a couple sunspots that are going to be facing the Earth in coming days. And one of these sunspots has been spitting out quite a few CMEs into space. Now, it's been on the far side of the sun, so these CMEs that have come out over the last week, three of them, are not going to hit the Earth, but this sunspot is turning toward us, and so we could be in the line of fire. And we are keeping an eye on those sunspots to see what happens this week. Our current space weather geomagnetic forecast calls for about a 35% chance of active conditions here at our mid-latitude in the next 24 hours, dropping to 25% over the next 24 to 48 hours. And a diminishing chance of minor or severe storms. We only have like a 5% chance of a severe storm in the next day. But if up at the higher latitudes, that chance of severe storm does bump up to a 50% probability in the next 24 hours, 40% in the 24 to 48 hours. So with the sunspots turning to face the Earth, we do have potential geomagnetic storms in the making. So what's happening in the night sky this week, Jay?
Thanks, Mike. I did aim my time-lapse north last night, just in the chance on that 35% chance to catching some aurora. And it was pretty much washed out by the moon. After the moon set, I did see a little bit of aurora glow on the northern horizon. So that was really nice. And actually caught a couple tarred meteors as well. And so there's been a lot of controversy and misinformation out there concerning Comet 3I Atlas, but like Elvis finally leaving the building, interstellar object 3I Atlas is now leaving the solar system. The interstellar object 3I Atlas, the third known visitor to our solar system from outside the solar system, has recently passed to its closest point to the sun, the perihelion, on October 29th, 2025. And now its sun is beginning its journey back out of our system. Though it has passed the sun, the object believed to be a comet from another star system has yet to make its closest approach to Earth, which will occur on around December 19th, 2025, at a distance of about 1. AU, or astronomical units. Currently, 3I Atlas is visually obscured behind the sun, making it unobservable, but it is expected to return to the eastern pre-dawn sky for those of us with a large telescope, at least an 8-inch telescope, around November 11th. So it's pretty dim. I did image it earlier this month, and it was just a little fuzzy dot. And of course, last Friday was Halloween. And astronomers view Halloween, October 31st, as a significant date beyond its modern traditions, as it aligns with a cross-quarter day. This astronomical marker falls approximately midway between the autumnal equinox and the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, representing one of the four major seasonal divisions observed by ancient cultures. This timing, which marks a transition toward the darkest part of the year, has deep roots in celestial observation. In modern times, the four cross-quarter days are often called Groundhog Day, February 2nd, May Day, May 1st, Lammas, August 1st, and the most sinister cross-quarter day, because it comes at the third time of the year, Halloween, October 31st. Adding to its cosmic significance, Halloween coincides with the peak activity of the Taurid meteor shower, earning its fragments the nickname Halloween fireballs. These annual meteors, which streak across the late October, early November sky, are often bright and are a regular feature for sky watchers. The Taurids are associated with the debris from the comet Encke, but sightings of the especially bright fireballs have led astronomers to investigate the possibility of a denser, potentially hazardous swarms within the streams. And that leads us to a news story, right, Mike?
That's right, Jay. I have to say that I really love the October, November, December. We have just a whole series of great meteor showers, starting with the Draconids, the Orionids, the Taurids, coming up in a few weeks, the Leonids, and then the Geminids and Ursids towards the mid-end of December. So, and I've been capturing a number of Taurid fireballs this week in my time lapses, and some of them have left persistent ion trains for, you know, 5-10 minutes, distorting very high in the upper atmosphere. At least one of my captures spanned two 10-second frames. Now, that's not to say it lasted for 20 seconds, just that it started in one 10-second frame and then continued on into the next 10-second frame. And there's at least a second gap between them. So I would estimate that that Taurid probably blazed for, based on the gap size and the constant speed, probably about 3 to 4 seconds crossing the sky where I captured it. So to the news story, researchers at University of New Mexico are warning us in a study published on October 29th this year that the Taurid meteor shower could pose an increased risk of an airburst over the Earth in the years 2032 and 2036. The annual Taurid showers are known for producing unusually bright meteors, also known as fireballs, which are thought to be indicators of a dense swarm of larger sized objects within that meteor stream. If this theoretical swarm does exist, new research suggests Earth will be in a position to encounter it, raising the possibility of atmospheric explosions similar to the 1908 Tunguska event, which flattened 80 million trees in Siberia. The scientists published their findings in the peer-reviewed journal Acta Astronautica. While the existence of the specific swarm is still considered theoretical, the lead author, Mark Boslow of the University of New Mexico, noted that observations of bright fireballs and seismic impacts on the moon have been seen at times predicted by the theory. This evidence suggests that a sparse cluster of these larger space objects, which astronomers suspect may even include large asteroids, could indeed be moving along the Taurid stream, increasing the risk of an atmospheric impact in the next decade. So that's our space news. We'd like to turn now to the topic today. We're taking a trip to the dark side to discuss dark matter and dark energy as part of a continuing series about cosmology and leading up to the current crisis in cosmology, or Hubble tension. And I think today we're going to just focus on dark matter. There's enough to talk about there that we'll save dark energy for our episode next week. But to recap and remind our listeners, we started talking about the cosmic microwave background radiation and the evidence that we get from the CMB for the age of the universe, the expansion rate of the universe. And that's really where the Hubble tension lies, is in that expansion rate. We then had an episode about the Cepheid variables, which give us a different estimate using the cosmic distance ladder to make direct measurements of current expansion rates. And those current expansion rates do not agree with the expansion rates we get based on the CMB research. So, dark matter. You know, my first question when I hear dark matter is, what is this and how do we know it exists? If it's not something we can see, you know, is this just speculation? So it helps to start by, you know, defining what matter, ordinary matter is. Ordinary matter is often referred to as baryonic matter because it's composed of baryons, which would include protons and neutrons. And when ordinary matter or baryonic matter will either reflect light or an electromagnetic radiation, or in some cases, that of a star, it will emit its own light. And so we can see these objects either visibly or at other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. But we know that there is something called dark matter that is distinct from baryonic matter, and that these particles, whatever they are, do not reflect, absorb, or emit electromagnetic radiation. Or if they do, it is so weak that we cannot possibly detect it from Earth using current technologies. Even though dark matter doesn't interact via electromagnetism, it does interact with another fundamental force, which is gravity. And it is through the interaction with gravity that we were first able to discover dark matter, and more recently have been able to accurately map it. So our story starts in 1933 with an astronomer at the California Institute of Technology named Fritz Zwicky. He used the Mount Wilson Observatory to measure the visible mass of the Coma cluster of galaxies. And he found that single galaxies in this cluster were moving too fast for the cluster to actually stay together based on the gravity of the visible matter. So Fritz Zwicky suggested there is an yet unobserved type of mass, dark matter, that might explain this disparity. Fritz Zwicky is sometimes called the father of dark matter, but this idea wouldn't be really taken seriously until after his death in 1974. And for this, we turn to the mother of dark matter, the Carnegie Institute astronomer Vera Rubin. She was studying the rotational dynamics of galaxies and, again, observed that there were stars at the edge of spiral galaxies far from the dense centers that were moving as fast as stars nearer to the center of the galaxy. And this was just odd. The visible mass of the galaxy shouldn't have enough gravitational influence to keep the stars moving rapidly in the sparsely populated outer regions. So there had to be some other force. And in this case, a huge amount of invisible matter in the outer regions of the galaxies away from the dense stellar populations in the core. Rubin calculated that the visible matter that she observed must account for just 10% of their mass. And when she revisited Fritz Zwicky's findings from around four decades before, she discovered a similar ratio of seen and unseen matter binding the Coma cluster. And I will say there is some, you know, dispute in among historians as to which of these two really discovered dark matter. And a lot of people are, or some people are, you know, fairly disappointed that Vera Rubin did not receive a Nobel Prize for her research. So since Rubin's discovery, astronomers have been using the gravitational influence of dark matter to see the location of dark matter. We have the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which in 2023 created a very precise map of dark matter visible through about a quarter of the sky visible over Earth and extending very deep into the universe. To do this, the team looked at distortions in the cosmic microwave background radiation, which we talked about in the first episode of this series. And we see basically a phenomenon like gravitational lensing going on in the cosmic microwave background radiation, and that gravitational lensing is the effect of the dark matter in the early universe. So at the time of the last scattering, about 380,000 years after the first Big Bang, the universe was cooling, and it reached a point at which the electrons could bind to protons and form the first atoms. And at that point, we see that the cosmic microwave background radiation in the expanding universe takes on the structure as caused by the gravitational distortions of dark matter. And that structure persists today. So we have a pretty good map, and this map has helped us to further prove yet again Einstein's theory of general relativity. There's a famous theoretical physicist, John Wheeler, said of general relativity, space-time tells matter how to move, matter tells space-time how to curve. And it is through this, insight that we are able to get a very accurate map of at least part of the universe's dark matter. I think it's also very cool that, we believe that that there are these clumps of dark matter around galaxies, and that they are linked with filaments between the galaxies. So you can almost envision this very dark kind of spider web, which I think here for our post-Halloween episode is just right on theme, that we can't see it, but there is this giant web throughout the universe of clumps of dark matter around galaxy linked by filaments of dark matter between galaxies. So a vast cosmic web. And with I should say that most of the universe is composed of dark matter and dark energy. Approximately 5% of the universe's mass is baryonic matter that we can observe. A vast majority of it, based on the effects of gravity and the rotational speed of galaxies and stars within galaxies. It seems, and we've demonstrated this a couple different ways, that most of the universe is not in the form of matter that we can see because it does not interact directly or strongly with electromagnetic radiation. So we're inferring this from the gravitational effects. So Jay, what do you think here? Have I left something important out?
Yeah, well, I've got a few questions, and I'm gonna kind of go over these kind of in simpler terms. And so, from my reading, is that when we talk about dark matter and dark energy, is and that that 5% number that you have for baryonic matter is so I'm seeing a number of about 27% of the universe is supposed to be made up of the dark matter, and then the remaining 68% of the non-baryonic energy and matter would probably be dark energy, which we'll discuss next week. And so is the supposition that that dark matter is likely subatomic particles? And my other kind of supposition or question would be, wouldn't just stuff that's in between the stars, the interstellar space, there might be matter that we just can't detect, that is just permeates the space between interstellar space? And what do you think about that as a description of where dark matter lies?
Yeah, those are great observations, Jay. And I believe that you've hit the kind of the most obvious explanations here. Subatomic particles that would be not interacting with electromagnetic radiation in a way that we can detect, but yet still having the mass that would create these effects of gravitational lensing that we see in the microwave background radiation. And yeah, if it's between galaxies, then there just is not a lot of electromagnetic radiation, you know, out there between space. And this is a place where I again put a pin into Olber's paradox, so that we can feature that after we get done with the Hubble tension. Because why is it that we're not seeing light in every part of the sky when we look up at night? If the universe is as big and vast as they say it is, shouldn't the night sky be as bright as the day sky? And it isn't. And so how could we see dark matter between galaxies if there is not a source of electromagnetic radiation to shine on them?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that when we talk about electromagnetic radiation, we're talking about massless, because photons do not have mass. And so when we talk about electromagnetic radiation, we're talking about energy. And so, you know, we see normal baryonic matter by the energy that it, like you said, reflects or radiates. And so, and this also leads us to something, gravitons and gravitational waves. And what do you know about the idea of gravitons or gravitational waves as related to dark matter?
You know, that's something that I'm just going to kind of take a pass on here, because I don't have a great understanding. I know, you know, a bit about gravitational waves, and that gravitons are, you know, a hypothetical elementary particle mediating the force of gravitational interactions. So, string theory would say that the graviton is a massless state of a string. And so, you know, some forms of graviton theories, you know, would not account for our dark matter if, in fact, it is massless.
Okay. And then just to clarify a little bit on gravitational lensing. When we talk about, especially with the new James Webb telescope, it's one of the first images that they released from the James Webb telescope was of, you know, a cluster of ancient galaxies, and some of those were gravitationally lensed galaxies. Can you speak about what gravitational lensing is when we're observing galaxies from the far past?
Yeah, light will normally travel in a straight line. There's nothing that's going to just cause a photon to turn in its path, except gravity. And so what we see is that when light is passing by a very massive object, that is the source of the light is on the other side of that massive object from our perspective, then it will appear to create this ring or lens around the object. And so we can actually, and this is part of how, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity has been demonstrated, is through the observation of this very distortion of the path of light. So we get gravitational lensing occurring, around galaxies, obviously. But then we also get it, as we talked about, through the effect of dark matter on the cosmic microwave background radiation, which we would expect to see, you know, a fairly uniform distribution of, but it's not. And the reason it's not is that the effects of dark matter have distorted that. And so what we see today is the kind of the imprint or fossil of the earlier state of the universe and the distribution of dark matter in it, which we presume to have, you know, stayed more or less the same.
Yeah, I just saw a really interesting map of imaging of the cosmic background radiation and its distribution, and the scientists are now calling it kind of a dipolar distribution. And in fact, in this kind of 360 degree global image, it actually kind of looked like the yin yang symbol, and I thought that was really, really fascinating. And then also, I just wanted to speak real quickly about some traditional physics rather than the physics that we've been talking about with Einsteinian physics and back toward more Newtonian physics. Is in galactic rotation, we were talking about the stars moving too fast on the periphery of these galaxies. And this is, because this is in comparison to the traditional physical model, which would include centrifugal force. And so, like a skater, a figure skater, that when they have their arms out wide, their fingertips are moving at a slower speed than when they bring their fingertips in, and they tend to spin faster. And so that would, as their fingertips get closer to their body and their center of mass, they rotate quicker. And so this is what we would expect to see in that gravitational galaxy rotation. And then, but this is not what we're seeing. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that the reason why the dark matter didn't conform to traditional physics as far as that goes.
Yes, that's an excellent point, and I appreciate you giving that analogy, Jay. I think that helps us.
And so, just to kind of summarize, so we think that dark matter is a form of matter, and probably likely maybe subatomic particles, and its effect is an attractive force, which is gravitational pull, which is pulling things closer together, and its distribution is clumped around and within galaxies. And this is an important is if dark matter w should slow the expansion of the universe and hold structures together. And so this is going to be interesting when we talk about next week dark energy.
That's right. And we, some people have suggested, well, maybe we're wrong about dark matter. Maybe our physics are actually wrong and we need to, revisit the math. And the evidence that dark matter is a real phenomenon, that it exists and has the effects that we think it exists is, confirmed a couple different ways. So dark energy is, I would say, a little bit more of a mystery, and we'll talk about that next week. There are, a little bit more suggestions that maybe, maybe our physics are off when it comes to dark energy.
Great. On that cliffhanger, we will thank all of our listeners for checking out this podcast. Be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. You can also check out our websites. Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com, and there's some great time lapses and meteor photos there. You should definitely check out this week. And mine is skylapser.com. And if you'd like to help us out, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee slash dot com slash Skylapser. And the intro music for this podcast is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky.
Wishing you all clear skies.